Hello, and welcome to part 51 of our series dedicated to the Beatles here on WHBC 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. With me, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, as we work to bring you the new episode dedicated to the Beatles here on our series, which we call How Music Changed. It's hard to believe, Heidi, this is already up to number 51.
It's unbelievable.
Incredible. And I've got a lot to cover, a lot that I need to say before we even play music in our first show. So let me get right into it, if I may. By late 1968, it seemed as that every single thing that the Beatles were doing, either together or apart, was taken to extremes. Their new single, Hey Jude, it was deliberately being designed to become the longest 45 RPM single that it could be. Its B-side, Revolution, was designed to raise the hackles of the hippie revolutionary crowd that was basically trying to always recruit the Beatles, particularly John, into their causes. Paul was, of course, trying to make Helter Skelter into the most hard rock song that has ever been performed by the Beatles, while also basically trying to maintain his gentle side. And John is continually trying to raise the ante in his own quest to alien himself from his public, who are trying to cling on to his older image. In this show, we're going to capture all of these extremes, if time allows us, by covering some of the things that were going on. Now, we had mentioned in the past number of shows, as we were playing the Beatles' preparatory tracks for the White Album.
Say that 10 times fast.
I couldn't even say it once slowly. But anyway, as the Beatles are trying to prepare their tracks for the White Album, we've had a whole bunch of things that eventually saw release on Anthology, and we were covering those in the past two shows. We also had plenty of opportunities in order to convey all of the controversy that was going on with the band and how it was really not a fun time at all for the group. Well, I want to pick up today with what was happening on some of the dates leading up to the time when their latest single was about to be released. This is taken straight from the book called The Beatles Chronicle, which I've been quoting considerably throughout this show as far as covering the Beatles chronology. The date here is August 22nd, 1968. Directly quoting the book. Tensions within the Beatles came to a head at the start of this session, and Ringo quit the group. Everyone privy to his decision was sworn to secrecy, however, so news didn't reach the press. But while Ringo left the country for a chance to think over his future, work did continue in his absence. On this first night without their drummer, the three remaining Beatles began the recording of Paul's Back in the USSR, taping five takes of a basic rhythm track. Paul was on drums, lead guitar naturally fell to George, and John took over bass. Meanwhile, 2 days later, on August 24th, with still no word being made at all about the situation of the Beatles perhaps now being reduced to a threesome, John Lennon appears on TV and makes a very public appearance with Yoko Ono. I'll read directly from the book Chronicle for the date, August 24. For much of the British viewing public, John and Yoko nailed their true colors to the mast during this remarkable TV appearance. An interview with David Frost on the fourth edition of his latest series, Frost on Saturday. Networked live from Wembley Studios by the capital's new ITV station, London Weekend Television. The word Beatles scarcely came into the conversation. John and Yoko were there to explain to Frost and his studio viewing audience their views about vibrations and about art in its manifest forms, demonstrating their beliefs via participation pieces typical of their recent exhibitions. Whether playing devil's advocate or otherwise, Frost was generally cautious, causing John and Yoko to enliven and heat up the discussion a few notches. The resulting interview was so novel that it merited a repeat in a highlight series, The Best of Frost. Now later on, again, the following week, Wednesday, August 28th, a short excerpt from there, back to Trident Studios. Now they're not at their normal home at Abbey Road. They're still at Trident, which the Beatles were recording at because they loved the 8-track machines that were at Trident. Abbey Road was still only using a 4-track.
Wow.
So that's why they recorded Hey Jude at Trident, and they were only really rehearsing it at Abbey Road. But that being the case, here they are, again, the quote, back to Trident, Ringo still absent. This time, the recording of John's Dear Prudence, Beginning in a 5 to 7 a.m. session, that's 14 hours, the Beatles creatively used the 8-track facility, piecing together the song instrument by instrument onto a one-take basic track of guitars and drums, again played by Paul. Interesting to note that when the album was released, the first two songs on the album, on side one of the four-sided album, featured drums played by Paul McCartney, not by Ringo. Rather incredible. Now, of course, in the midst of all this, Hey Jude, which was always designed from the very beginning to be a single, the Beatles had no intention of including it on the album at all. Again, as the Beatles always wanted to give value for the money, they didn't consider singles to be something that you would put on an album. So they recorded Hey Jude exclusively for use as the hit single. I've got a bunch of quotes from the Beatles regarding the circumstances of recording that song and a few other rather unpleasant incidents that surrounded that as well. First to discuss this is George Harrison. The Apple shop was now empty. If you recall, we were talking last week about how they had abandoned their their attempt at retail. And it was suggested that we advertise the new single in the window. So somebody went with whitewash and wrote Hey Jude and Revolution in big letters. The next day, the shop window was smashed. Apparently because somebody thought it was like Juden in the Nazi campaign before the war. Paul McCartney. I went into the Apple shop just before Hey Jude was being released. The windows were whited out, and I thought, great opportunity. Baker Street, millions of buses going around. So before anyone knew what it meant, I scraped Hey Jude out of the whitewash. A guy who had a delicatessen nearby rang me up, and he was furious. I'm going to send one of my sons round to beat you up. I said, hang on, what's this about? And he said, you've written Jude in the shop window. I had no idea it meant Jew. But if you're looking at footage of Nazi Germany, Judenrausch was written in whitewashed windows with the Star of David. I swear it never occurred to me. All that Paul was trying to do was change the name Julian, which he had originally written the song as Jules, to Jude, which was a shortened version of the name Judah or Judas, he having no intention whatsoever to have it be the German word for Jew. So anyway, Paul goes on to say,
it's rather naive of him, especially after all the time that he spent in Germany.
Right. But he just wrote it not thinking that it would be a sensitive thing, but it turned out quite otherwise. I said, I'm really sorry, and on, some of my best friends are Jewish, really. It's just a song we've got coming out. If you listen to the song, you'll see it's nothing to do with any of that. It's a complete coincidence. He was just about pacified in the end. George, Hey Jude was actually written about Julian Lennon. It was written by Paul at the time John was splitting up with Cynthia. Julian was just a little boy, probably 5 years old, and Paul had gone out to John's house and been affected by seeing Julian, the innocent bystander in a divorce situation. Paul McCartney again. When John and Cynthia got married, it didn't really work. There was a beautiful kid, and they were quite happy for a while, but my estimation of it was that Cynthia wanted to tie John down to the pipe and slippers nice life, and of course, John was never ready for that. John was a great jumper off of cliffs. I often remember him saying, look, if you've come to a cliff, why don't you jump off it? I would say, you could probably get dead, John. He was always coming up with harebrained schemes, so I developed a defense against them. I'll tell you what, you do it first and give us a shout. If it's okay, I'm jumping. If I hear nothing, I'm staying here. He came up to me once at a dinner and said, have you ever thought about trepanning? It's an ancient Roman thing. You have a hole drilled in your skull. And we talked about it a lot, as you did in the 60s. I said, no, not really. He said, I think we should all have it done. I was still saying, I don't know not about that. You have it done, and if it's fine, we'll all have it done as well. That was the only way to get rid of John's madcap schemes. Otherwise, he would have had us all with holes in our heads the next morning. So John and Cynthia were splitting up, but I felt particularly sorry for Julian. I had known them for so long. We had hung out since John's art school days when I had a girlfriend called Dot and John had Cynthia, and we used to foursome it a lot and go to parties together. Since then, I'd seen them get married and seen them have Julian. I thought, as a friend of the family, I would motor out to Weybridge and tell them that everything was all right to try and cheer them up, basically, and see how they were. I had about an hour's drive. I would always turn the radio off and try to make up songs, just in case. I started singing, Hey Jules, don't make it bad, take a sad song and make it better. It was optimistic, a hopeful, hopeful message for Julian. Come on, man, your parents got divorced. I know you're not happy, but you'll be okay. I eventually changed Jules to Jude. One of the characters in Oklahoma is called Judd, and I like the name. I played the song to John when I'd finished it, although I thought there might be a little more to do because there was one passage which went, "The movement you need is on your shoulder." As I was playing it, I looked at John and said, "I'll fix that bit." "What?" "I've used the word shoulder once already, and anyway, it's a stupid expression. It sounds like a parrot. I'll change it." John said, "You won't, you know. That's the best line in the song. I know what it means. It's great." That was the good thing about John, whereas I'd definitely have knocked that line out, he would say it was great. Then I could see it through his eyes. So when I play that song, that's the line when I think of John, and I sometimes get a little emotional during that moment. John Lennon. "Hey Jude" is one of his masterpieces. He said it was written about Julian, my child. He knew I was splitting with Sin and leaving Julian. He was driving over to say hi to Julian. He'd been like an uncle to him. Paul was always good with kids, and so he came up with "Hey Jude." But I always heard it as a song to me. If you think about it, Yoko's just come into the picture. He's saying, "Hey Jude, hey John." I know I'm sounding like one of those fans who reads things into it, but you can hear it as a song to me. The words, "Go out and get her." Subconsciously, he was saying, "Go ahead, leave me." But on a conscious level, he didn't want me to go ahead. The angel inside him was saying, "Bless you." The devil in him didn't like it at all because he didn't want to lose his partner. George Martin, the Beatles record producer. We recorded "Hey Jude" in Trident Studios. It was a long song. In fact, after I timed it, I actually said, "You can't make a single that long." I was shouted down by the boys, not for the first time in my life, and John asked, "Why not?" I couldn't think of a good answer, really, except the pathetic one that disc jockeys wouldn't play it. He said, "They will if it's us." And of course, he was absolutely right. Paul McCartney. It was longer than any single had been, but we had a good bunch of engineers. We asked how long a 45 could be. They said that 4 minutes was about all you could squeeze into the grooves before it seriously started to lose volume and everyone had to turn the sound up. But they did some very clever stuff, squeezing the bit that didn't have to be loud, then allowing the rest more room. Somehow, they got 7 minutes on there, which was quite an engineering feat. I remember taking an acetate down to the Vesuvio, a 3 in the morning dossing down on beanbags type club in Tottenham Court Road. As it was a suitable time in the evening, I got the DJ to put it on. I remember Mick Jagger coming up to me and saying, "It's like two songs, man. It's got the song and then there's the whole na-na-na at the end. Yeah." I was always a bit in limbo with a new single. Your heart's in your mouth when you first hear it played on the radio, for instance. I knew it was a lot to expect people to swallow the whole thing. Maybe they would want to fade it, but they didn't. I remember Stuart Henry on the Beeb saying, "There you are, my friends. Either you like it or you don't." Then he went on to the next record. I thought, "Thank you. Couldn't you have thought of anything else, Stu?" Last words to Ringo before I take over. "Hey Jude" has become a classic. It felt good recording it. We put it down a couple of times trying to get it right, and like everything else, it just clicked. That's how it should be. Now, with all my talk about these times and how rough it was for the Beatles, the fact that I even have this radio show all comes down to the fact that I wrote a book about a long time ago, as it turns out now, maybe 16 years ago when I published American Hit Radio. At the time, I wrote an essay about the song "Hey Jude." When I originally considered the book, the original idea for me to write it was to arrange my own personal 500 favorite songs in the order that I liked them, which was a Sisyphean task, almost impossible, really. But I knew that if I did it, I wanted to have "Hey Jude" as the number one song. It turned out that that was like a dumb idea because, after all, everybody's list of 500 is going to be completely different and it wouldn't really mean anything. So eventually, I decided to arrange them in the book in a chronological order so they sort of told a story. Smartest thing I could have done. But the essay still stands from the way that I wrote it about 16 or 17 years ago when I put it down into words in the early 90s. And with all that we've been discussing about the difficulties of the Beatles and about this being a real transition point, I think I ought to read that essay now in the midst of this series. So here then is what I wrote, entitled "Hey Jude, the Beatles," from the book American Hit Radio. I open it with two quotes. "The dream is over," John Lennon from God. And, "When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways," which is from the book of Corinthians, chapter 13, verse 13. The time had come for the Beatles to give up their childish ways. It was hard to imagine that fewer than 5 years had passed since America discovered the Beatles, because so much had changed since then. The very fabric of our culture had been inexorably altered, and the Beatles, who were in the eye of this tempestuous hurricane, changed with us. In retrospect, the overall impression of 1964 that lingered was that of a virginal innocence becoming aroused by the prospects of an exciting future. In 1964, Americans had nothing more to be afraid of in popular culture than the androgynous nature of the Beatles' haircuts. From the vantage point of 1968, it was easy to look back wistfully at the optimism of those times. The Beatles themselves must have felt similarly. The overwhelming excitement of suddenly having the most famous four faces in the world, coupled with the energy and talent to rise up to the expectations of the masses, must have given them at least some sense of satisfaction and pride in their achievement, even if it was only short-lived. Human nature and time can be killers, though. They inevitably will disrupt anything that appears to be static and will wear down even the hardest of surfaces. Initially, the tumultuous events that surrounded the Beatles brought them closer together. The band became something of a private men's club containing four exclusive members. Even wives and girlfriends were kept outside of the fold. Their manager, Brian Epstein, acted as a doorman who prevented all interlopers from entering the private sanctum. But now, Brian was dead. The four Beatles, who lived like pharaohs, were never as innocent as their audience perceived them to be, but drugs, sex, money, and now the death of their manager had irreparably corrupted their outlook and disrupted the framework that held them together. Even the peripheral aspects of their lives, which is pretty much where you stood if you were a Beatle wife or girlfriend, began to disintegrate. John Lennon's marriage to his wife Cynthia was essentially over, and Paul McCartney's long-term relationship with Jane Asher had fallen apart as well. Not only the Beatles, but everybody else was going through similar turmoil. Law-abiding, respectful youth had learned about drugs, and many of us didn't hesitate to experiment with them. We began to question authority and even protested openly against the government. First, Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered, and then Robert Kennedy. The summer of love had become a near-forgotten, seemingly perverted dream. We, all of us, were no longer innocent. All of a sudden, we became older but wiser. The Beatles, because of their fame and notoriety, became our sacrificial lamb. They, not the Rolling Stones, were the butterfly to be broken on a wheel. But who really was to blame? Why was a sacrifice necessary? What else could be eviscerated to make right this divisive and troubled time? Time. Time was the problem, and time held the solution. Maturity could loosely be defined as an awareness of yourself coupled with a loss of innocence. Time only makes us older. Experience and awareness makes us wiser. Hey Jude was McCartney's way of coming to terms with the changes that were happening all around him. His lyrics could be directed at John and Cynthia's breakup, a means of cheering up their child Julian, or a way of putting McCartney's own life in perspective, but they work best when perceived on a global scale. Letting go of your childhood innocence is a rite of passage that is always taken reluctantly. Hey Jude points the way and says essentially, it's all right to move on. An entire generation was simultaneously developing a new awareness. Whether you were 9 or 29, you heard the message. The Beatles even supplied us with a 4-minute mantra to chant in unison while we learned to accept our pain. One of the most beautiful and transcendent moments in all of music occurs when the lyrics give way to the chanting chorus. The combination of pain and pleasure at that moment is immeasurably powerful. The na-na-na-na-na-na-na chorus is just as life-affirming as the earlier yeah, 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 but less childish and more realistic. McCartney's ad-libbed vocal lines are among the most expressive singing he has ever done, letting us know just how important and cathartic this moment is for him. 7 minutes and 11 seconds encapsulates a lifetime of experience and captures the moment when we became vaguely aware that the Beatles, by necessity, were nearing the end of their existence together. Symbolically, Hey Jude was the first Beatles record that was released on their own Apple Records label, and it became the biggest hit of their career when it remained at number one for 9 weeks. With a song that was intended to show the world that, as a group, they were as strong as ever, they acknowledged the importance of their individual independence. In 1 year's time, the Beatles would disintegrate completely, but by then, Hey Jude would justify the entire experience.
Is someone knocking out there now? Is that my imagination?
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to make it better.
try to get in the full 7 minutes and 11 seconds there. Number one for 9 weeks. The first time any of us had seen the Apple logo on the label. It was the first Beatles product, at least, released with the Apple on the label. 36-piece orchestra scored by George Martin. 10 violins, violas, cellos, flutes, contrabassoon, bassoon, clarinets, bass clarinets, trumpets, trombones, horns, percussion, 2-string basses. Huge amount of accompaniment for the Beatles on that track. Another little story that's worth telling, just a little piece of trivia information for Beatles freaks. Hard to talk about this on the radio because I can't say the word. But buried in that song at about the 3-minute mark, just before they switch over to the na-na-na-na-na part, you hear some talking in the background, a bunch of words. You hear somebody go like, whoa, and then you hear, woo-woo. Well, that apparently, if you listen closely, you can hear somebody says a very rude word, and it was kept on purpose. Apparently, it was said that actually John said that he got a huge feedback into his headphones, and he had to rip them off. And as he did, he made the exclamation, and then he wanted to keep it on the record because John was like that, being the subversive that he was. So he wanted to bury it in the mix so that people wouldn't hear it until many years later when it would come out, which is exactly what did happen. And now people are aware of it. So if you're a bit inclined to be, as people are with a lot of Beatles stuff, to dig and look really deeply on the CD, you'll probably hear it at about the 2-minute 58 or 3-minute mark where that actually takes place. Meanwhile, the B-side of the record was being prepared. And I've got a bunch of quotes for the Beatles for this now. John had originally recorded the song Revolution with the Beatles as a slow number, and he wanted that to be the single. But the Beatles basically were totally against that idea. They thought that, it was too political, and it was too slow. So Lennon was not going to do anything about the political bit. As far as he was concerned, too bad. He wanted to make a political statement. But he did decide that he could do something about the slowness of the song, so he responded with a rearrangement that made the song the noisiest Beatles track yet. It was a machine gun blast of fuzzy distortion with at nearly twice the tempo of the original song, just this blast of insane energy. And he still wanted it to be the A-side, still until his dying day, believed that it should have been released as a single on its own. As it is, the B-side charted at number 12. Let's hear a few Beatles quotes to catch us up with the point, though, with the single and what was happening. First, Neil Aspinall, the Beatles manager. David Frost came down to Twickenham Film Studios where they were filming a performance of Hey Jude and Revolution, and he introduced it like it was done specifically for his show or something. It was filmed with an invited audience, and they all got up on stage and sang the chorus repeat for Hey Jude. George Harrison. We made a film in front of an audience. They had brought people in for Hey Jude. It wasn't done just for David Frost, but it was shown on his show, and he was actually there when we filmed it. George Martin, the producer. The other side of Hey Jude was Revolution. We got into distortion on that, which we had a lot of complaints from the technical people about. But that was the idea. It was John's song, and the idea was to push it right to the limit. Well, we went to the limit and beyond. George. The thing about Revolution, the song, and you could get into a debate about this, is that it's not so much the song but the attitude in which it was done. I think Revolution is pretty good and it grooves along, but I don't particularly like the noise that it makes, and I say noise because I didn't like the distorted sound of John's guitar. I think that Revolution, as with all the different styles of song, has its own merit. It's a good tune, but I don't think it is one of John's best songs. The only thing that may make it important is what it's actually saying. But at the same time, there was a lot of other politically aware music going on around the world. John. When George and Paul and all of them were on holiday, I made Revolution, which is on the LP. I wanted to put it out as a single, but they said it wasn't good enough. We put out Hey Jude, which was worthy, but we could have had both. We recorded the song twice. The Beatles were getting real tense with each other. The first take, George and Paul were resentful and said it wasn't fast enough. Now, if you go into the details of what a hit record is and isn't, maybe. But the Beatles could have afforded to put out the slow, understandable version of Revolution as a single, whether it was a gold record or a wooden record. But because they were so upset over the Yoko thing and the fact that I was again becoming as creative and dominating as I was in the early days, after lying fallow for a couple of years, it upset the apple cart. I was awake again and they weren't used to it. I wanted to put out what I felt about Revolution. I thought it was about time we spoke about it, the same as I thought it was about time we stopped not answering about the Vietnamese War. I had been thinking about it up in the hills in India. I still had this God will save us feeling about it. It's going to be all right. That's why I did it. I wanted to talk. I wanted to say my piece about revolutions. I wanted to tell you, or whoever listens, to communicate, to say, what do you say? This is what I say. There were two versions of that song, but the underground left only picked up on the one that said, count me out. The original version, which ends up on the LP, said, count me in, too. I put in both because I wasn't sure. I didn't want to get killed. I didn't really know much about the Maoists. I just knew that they seemed to be so few, and yet they painted themselves green and stood in the front of the police waiting to get picked off. I thought it was unsubtle. I thought the original communist revolutionaries coordinated themselves a bit better and didn't go around shouting about it. Ringo. I never felt we'd gone too far ever. Not musically, and not in life, really. We didn't really do anything heavy in life. We didn't get radical. We were a little radical in our music, so it seems, with the backwards tapes and things like that, but we were not violent people. Johnson sums up his routine in a really awesome quote that I'm going to cut down a little bit because it goes on quite long. The statement in Revolution was mine. The lyrics stand today. They're still my feeling about politics. I want to see the plan. That's what I used to say to Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. Count me out if it's for violence. Don't expect me on the barricades unless it's with flowers. As far as overthrowing something in the name of Marxism or Christianity, I want to know what you're going to do after you've knocked it down. I mean, can't we use some of it? What's the point of bombing Wall Street? If you want to change the system, change the system. It's no good shooting people. If you want peace, you won't get it with violence. Please tell me one militant revolution that worked. Sure, a few of them took over, but what happened? Status quo. And if they smash it down, who do you think is going to build it up again? And then, when they've built it up again, who do they think is going to run it? And how are they going to run it? They don't look further than their noses. If someone showed me one that worked, then I might turn me a bit. I'd say, all right, that's the way to do it. Then turn the place upside down. But there isn't one. The system-smashing scene has been going on forever. What's it done? The Irish did it, the Russians did it, and the French did it. And where's it got them? It's got them nowhere. It's the same old game. Who's going to run this smashing up? Who's going to take over? It'll be the biggest smashers. They'll be the ones to get in first, and they'll be the ones to take over. I don't know what the answer is, but I think it's down to people. What I said in Revolution, in all the versions, is change your head. These people that are trying to change the world can't even get it all together. They're attacking and biting each other's faces, and all the time they're all pushing the same way. And if they keep going on like that, it's going to kill it before it's even moved. It's silly to complain about each other and be trivial. They've got to think in terms of at least the world or the universe and stop thinking in terms of factories and one country. If you think of the you say in order to change the world, we've got to understand what's wrong with the world and then destroy it. Ruthlessly. You're obviously on a destruction kick. I'll tell you what's wrong with it, people. Do you want to destroy them ruthlessly? Until you change your own heads, there's no chance. Who messed up communism, Christianity, capitalism, Buddhism, etc.? Sick heads and nothing else. Do you think all the enemy wear capitalist badges so you can shoot them? If you think of the establishment or whoever they are, the blue meanies, you've got to remember that they're the sick ones. And if you've got a sick child in the family, you don't kick it out the door. You've got to try and look after it or extend a hand to it. So somewhere along the line, we've got to make a meeting point with whoever they are, because even amongst them, there are some human beings. In fact, they're all human. But there's some that even look like it and respond like it. So it's up to us, if we're the aware generation, to extend a hand to the retarded child and not just kick its teeth in because it happens to be a very big child. The only way to ensure a lasting peace of any kind is to change people's minds. There's no other way. The government can do it with propaganda. Coca-Cola can do it with propaganda. Why can't we? We're the hip generation. Eventually, it will happen. It has to happen. Might not happen now, or it might not happen in 50 or 100 years. Here's Revolution by the Beatles.
Evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world.
But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Alright. You say you got a real solution. Well, you know, we don't love to see the plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all do what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait. All right. All right. All right. Institution. Well, you know, you better free your mind instead. But if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't gonna make it with anyone anyhow. Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. All right.
On vinyl, the Beatles never wasted a second.
All right, already.
Incredible. I would say a band that put out some of the best two-sided singles in the history of rock and roll just put out another one, one that was incredibly deep and meaningful on both sides of the record, rivaled just about anything else they had ever released, especially as a single. It was a huge turning point. It's weird to imagine that that single was released on the public at a time when Ringo was actually still apart from the band. He quit on the before
was
this
MIA.
Was released, and he was still MIA. Well, that changed on September 3rd. That track was released on August 26th, 1968. On September 3rd, they got word that Ringo was going to be returning to the studio. So again, reading directly from the Chronicle. His drum kit, smothered in flowers, arranged there by Mal Evans, Ringo rejoined the Beatles with this session, although ironically there was nothing for him to do. And though he was back, George Martin was absent, now away on holiday. He wouldn't work with the group again until October 1st. Balance engineer Ken Scott ran the control room on this night. Recording at Trident had whetted the Beatles' appetite. They now wanted all of their recordings to be A-track. So when they got to hear that EMI Studios did actually have a 3M A-track recorder, but that it was still in the office of technical expert Francis Thompson, they decided to liberate it. An action which, although the Beatles themselves were considered beyond reproach, almost resulted in the dismissal of technical engineer Dave Harries, who did the dirty work for them. Rather incredibly, Dave Harries was this young guy who just was brought in by George Martin as an assistant, and now George Martin's on vacation, and here he is in a position of power working with the Beatles at 21 years old, and he almost gets immediately fired because he helps them steal the 8-track machine out of the office. Going on then to the very next day, September 4th, again, reading from the Chronicle. Needing to shoot promo clips for both sides of the new single, Hey Jude Revolution, that's when the Beatles came to Twickenham, arriving at 1:30 p.m. and working through the afternoon and evening in Stage 1 on a set built over the previous 3 days. Michael Lindsay-Hogg was the director, having previously worked with the Beatles on Paperback Writer and the Rain clips. this being the first time that the group had used a recognized director for a promo shoot since February of 1967. Two finished clips were made for each of the two songs, all four being videotaped in color. Hey Jude was done first, with Paul sitting at an upright piano, John and George sitting on an adjacent podium playing guitars, and Ringo sitting at the drums up and behind them. The Beatles were also augmented by a 36-piece orchestra decked out in white tuxedos, and for the extended refrain, by 300 extras from teenager to pensioner recruited after 20 students had distributed leaflets in the area, and Mal Evans had invited along fans congregated outside EMI Studios during a recent recording session. It's worth noting at this point, by the way, that the orchestra that was played was offered a double fee if they would just clap their hands and sing along during the track. Most of them complied, except for one who reportedly said, "I'm not going to clap my hands and sing Paul McCartney's bloody song."
Well.
So he ended up not getting the double fee for turning it down. So anyway, the world premiere of Hey Jude in visual form occurred during the sixth edition of the London weekend television series Frost on Sunday. To fake the illusion that the Beatles were appearing exclusively on his program, live and in the studio, David Frost came to Twickenham this afternoon and was taped on the Hey Jude set introducing the Beatles. First, they scooted through a version of Frost's long-established theme music, which happened to be composed by George Martin, and then Frost spoke into the camera, as only he can, saying, "Magnificent! A perfect rendition. Ladies and gentlemen, there you see the greatest tea room orchestra in the world. It's my pleasure to introduce now, in their first live appearance for goodness knows how long in front of an audience, the Beatles." There was, of course, no audience. At this point, the Beatles dropped into a shocking parody of Elvis Presley's It's Now or Never, but viewers of Frost on Sunday did not see this. They saw instead the seamless edit into the film of Hey Jude. In the USA, Hey Jude and Revolution were screened in color on successive editions of the CBS TV series The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, shown on October 6th and later on October 13th on that show. After all this is done, now the Beatles get back to work, working on the remaining tracks for the White Album. Let's play a pickup then where we left off last week with the track that was being recorded on September 16th. Here's Paul McCartney running through a rough take of a song, trying to get the last bits crammed in to see how much they could actually fit on what they now decided is ultimately going to have to be a double album. Paul with a new song that he's trying out entitled I Will.
Who knows how long I've loved you, yeah. No, I love you still. Will I wait a lonely lifetime if you want me to? I will. You know, if I ever saw you, I didn't catch your name, but it never really mattered. I will always feel the same. Love you forever and forever. Love you with all my heart. Love you whenever we're together. Love you with all my heart. And when at last I find you, your song will fill the air. When it loud so I can hear you, make it easy to be near you, for the things you do, endear me to you, oh, you know I will.
That's a pretty little song by Paul.
It is. It's just
nice
adorable.
Love song that he had written around this time. Now we're going to move right into October. These are really, now this is at the very end of the sessions now, trying to figure out, it's actually the fifth month of recording for the White Album. John had a couple more songs that he was pulling together at around this time. And on the anthology, they were kind enough to include one of the songs that John was trying to get squeezed into the album as well. One of my favorite songs from the White Album. Here's an early take of the song called I'm So Tired.
Okay, this is it. Ha. One, two, three. I'm so tired, I haven't slept a wink. I'm so tired, my mind is on the blink. I wonder, should I get up and fix myself a drink? No, 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 I'm so tired, I don't know what to do. I'm so tired, my mind is set on you. I wonder, should I call you? But I know what you would do. You'd say, I'm putting you on, but it's no joke. It's doing me harm, you know I can't sleep. I can't stop my brain, you know it's 3 weeks. I'm going insane, you know I'd give you everything I've got for a little peace of mind. I'm so tired, I'm feeling so upset. Although I'm so tired, I'll have another cigarette. And curse Sir Walter Raleigh, he was such a stupid get. You'd say, I'm putting you on, but it's no joke. It's doing me harm, you know I can't sleep. I can't stop my brain, you know it's 3 weeks. I'm going insane, I'd give you everything I've got for a little peace of mind. Give you everything I've got for a little peace of mind. Give you everything I've got for a little peace of mind.
It's weird to hear it without the blissom, 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 blissom. But we'll be getting into that in a couple of shows or a few shows going forward, because we will definitely want to be covering the Paul is Dead mystery, which has a lot to do with that mumble there.
Irony there, huh?
It's also interesting to note that around this time in late October, I mean, a lot of people, when they first heard the White Album, they'd hear a song like a little short ditty like Why Don't We Do It in the Road, and they'd see what could have possibly compelled Paul to write a song like that. And you don't have to look any further than his partner, John Lennon, who was doing every single thing that he possibly could to upset the apple cart, so to speak, as George put it in the song Not Guilty. So with so much, you know, going on in Georgia's side, Paul was really not a goody-goody two-shoes at all. He wanted to write a couple of things that were off. It was Paul that wrote Helter Skelter, and it was Paul that figured he could get a little bit funky with this short little ditty, also recorded just a month before the album was put into a bag and completed. Here's an early take of Why Don't We Do It in the Road.
Why don't we do it in the road? 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 No one will be watching us. Why don't we do it in the road?
Why don't we do it in the road? Why don't we do it in the road? Why don't we do it in the road? Yeah, why don't we do it in the road? No one will be watching us. Why don't we do it in the road?
Why don't we do it in the road? Why don't we do it in the road? Why don't we do it in the road? Why don't we do it in the road?
No one will be watching us. Why don't we do it in the road?
Why don't we do it in the road? Why don't we do it in the road? Why don't we do it in the road?
watching us. Why don't we do it in the road?
Why don't we do it in the road?
Well, well, well. What do you think of all that? Do you think I could do it better?
What he eventually decided was to do it with a band rather than doing it acoustically, but that was rather interesting. The very last song that was recorded for the White Album was actually one of John's. He came in on October 13th. It was time to wrap up the sessions, and he had written this really gorgeous love song using his mother's name, Julia, something that would obviously an obsession with him that he, up until this point, had really never really verbalized much as a Beatle to many people. It would become a focal point of his solo career, of course, and a very beautiful song. He gets to address a little bit of like some thoughts that he was keeping inside for a while that he could express in a very gentle way on this song. As I said, the last song recorded for what would be called the White Album. Here's John singing an early take of Julia.
It was till then.
Try it again. There was one or two little discrepancies.
There was just the one, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I couldn't I go from there, you know? Cause no. Because that one was perfect, wasn't it?
All right, then. That's about it now. With the little bit of time that we've got left, if you recall, it was a number of shows ago when I actually played John Lennon and Yoko Ono's very first album together, the Unfinished Music number one that had come out. And it was amazingly, with a naked cover on it and everything else. I had to play that at the time when it was recorded because we needed to set up a feeling for the times. Well, when that album was actually released to the public with the naked jacket and everything, was very in very close proximity to the release of the White Album. So to cover this, brace yourselves, people. I am going to be playing that album next week before I get to the White Album because I want to cover all the controversy that was going on around that album. I will not be playing that album again. I'm not that crazy. What I will be doing is I'm going to be playing bits from the second album that they released together, Life with the Lions. And while that plays, I'll be able to discuss a lot of what was happening historically with the Beatles and especially with John and Yoko at this point in time, including John's arrest. So we'll be covering that next week. When it came out on the CD, it was amazingly, lucky us, we got two bonus tracks. I'm going to try to cover them now. So let's hear one track from the bonus tracks anyway, from the album Life with the Lions, sung by Yoko. This is called Song for John.
On a windy day, let's go on flying. There may be no trees to rest on. There may be no clouds to ride. But we'll have our wings, and the wind will be with us. That's enough for me. That's enough for me.
back of the end of them in the tapes.
Okay.
And I had to play that there for, I don't know if it's quite as obvious, but John Lennon's guitar part on that song is almost identical to his guitar part in Julia, at least certainly in terms of the way that he's picking. It's the exact same rhythm that he uses on both songs. It's also one of the prettier things that Yoko had ever done. Life with the Lions is anything but a pretty album. We'll get into that next week. In fact, it's probably one of the most unlistenable things I've ever heard in my entire life. So the bonus track there called Song for John was actually a beautiful little addition to an otherwise impossible album. The other bonus track is what we're hearing in the background now as I speak, something which they simply entitled Mulberry. More like what the rest of Life with the Lions is, which is to say really sort of like random noise. Actually a little bit more palatable even still than that album. For at least you hear John playing guitar, even though he might be playing it in a non-musical way. Believe me, the album itself is going to be much worse next week. But this is called Mulberry, and what's worth listening to perhaps on this more than anything else is, as I listen to the timbre of the instrument that he's playing, I want to say, go, Johnny, go, just like George did on Let It Be, because I believe that that's the exact same acoustic lap slide guitar that John is using now that he uses on that song. If you can listen to it, you might hear the same sort of a tone from the instrument.
Frightening.
Anyway, I'll leave you with that. And I hope you can join us next week. It will be a trying show, part number 52, but it will be filled with huge amounts of information, as I hope this one was as well. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you all next week. Thanks, everybody.